Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the euro crisis, where a default on Greek debt seems all but inevitable. We will speak with Domenico Lombard, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He is an expert in international monetary relations and global currencies. We will discuss whether the current crisis will involve an orderly or disorderly Greek default and examine the lack of solidarity and the apparent north-south divide within the eurozone. Then we'll be joined by a veteran Middle East negotiator who has served six secretaries of state, Aaron David Miller. We will analyze the state of Palestine before the UN votes on its statehood on Friday and discuss Aaron David Miller's article in Foreign Policy, Humpty Dumpty Palestine. Then we will look into the just-released report from the Census Bureau that finds poverty in the United States has climbed to an all-time record with 46.2 Americans living in poverty, many of them children. Alice O'Connor, a historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Poverty Knowledge, Social Science, Social Policy, and the Poor in 20th Century U.S. History, joins us. And joining us now is Domenico Lombard, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, specializing in global economy and development. He is an expert on G20 and G8 summits, international monetary relations, and global currencies. His current projects focus on the recent international financial crisis, the ongoing European crisis, and the reforms of the IMF and the World Bank. Welcome to Background Briefing, Domenico Lombard.
Thank you very much for having me.
And let's begin with Italy. I take it you have some relationship to Italy?
I am originally from Italy, that's correct.
So what is the story now that's out saying that China might buy the Italian debt?
Well, first of all, let me step back and, kind of overview what's going on in Italy and why Italy really holds the key to further developments of the euro area crisis. The government has issued two budget supplementary plans in less than 2 months. The first was issued in July, and yet did not manage to prevent a further wave of speculative attacks which materialized between the end of July and early August, at which point the government issued a further supplementary budget plan, which is supposed to be approved by the lower chamber of the parliament this week. The Senate already approved it last week. And yet, because in my view it is highly ineffective, it does not really tackle the root, structural issues that are driving this crisis, that is how to enhance the very low rate of growth of the Italian economy in order to better sustain the increasing burden on the public debt. Because it does not really tackle this issue, I think, again, it's going to prove highly ineffective, and the country will be heading towards a further wave of speculative attacks. The only problem is that Italy is a too large economy to be bailed out by the IMF or even by the EU institutions. Greece, Portugal, Ireland are all under IMF programs and EU programs. But, you know, their size is relatively small. It's not systemic at all. Italy, unfortunately, is too large of an economy to be managed through a traditional instrument. And this is why, we're saying at the outset that really Italy holds the key, because if, the authorities are able to prevent an escalation of the crisis, they would be able to prevent also the prospect of an immediate meltdown of the euro. In contrast, if they do not manage to do so, the prospect of an imminent meltdown of the euro would then materialize with, of course, some predictable consequences, not just for the euro area, but also for the global economy and the global financial system itself.
So, Domenico Lombard, you're saying then that the Italian crisis is the real one, in the sense that it is too big to fail and too big to bail. There are obviously political problems within Italy, and I don't believe that the Berlusconi government is particularly popular in Italy and has a lot of credibility abroad. But what about the Greek crisis? That seems to be the immediate one. So give us a sense of what the priorities are here, because on Wednesday, the President of France and the Chancellor of Germany apparently going to hold a video conference with the Greek Prime Minister as a last-ditch effort. And we know on Thursday, or on Friday, Timothy Geithner is going to be at a conference in Poland, which and the president has Obama has already weighed in, suggesting that the big European countries have got to more effectively coordinate fiscal policy. So walk us through the relative crisis nature of these other crises. And
sure. Of course, these crises are all interconnected because these countries, they all share the same currency. And beyond that, they are all heavily integrated in terms of trade, in terms of financial flows, and economically, broadly speaking. That's right. The Greek crisis at this moment poses the highest challenge. The IMF and the EU, were supposed to hold a review of the performance of Greece under the current program of assistance, and yet this review was postponed due to lack of progress by the Greek government on a number of structural reforms that the Greek authorities had committed to. These reforms, are all structural reforms, improvement in the tax system, measures aimed at increasing the rate of growth of the economy in the long run through a large-scale privatization program. And yet, on many fronts, the joint EU-IMF mission that visited Athens only a few days ago found essentially almost no progress at all. Now, what's next? Clearly, Greece does need the money to be disbursed at the end of this review, otherwise it will go into an outright default. And this is what, in a way, needs to be avoided, this outright default, because it would trigger unpredictable consequences throughout the euro area, because these economies are so highly interconnected. You cannot really isolate or contain the problems in a surgical manner. And therefore, if Greece were to go through an outright default, of course, it would be very difficult to draw the line, where these consequences would really stop.
So obviously, the choice here is between a controlled default or an uncontrolled default. And what explains, though, Domenico Lombard, what appears to be, been going on for some years, in fact, is the European response to the debt crisis has always seemed to be behind the curve. What explains that?
Indeed, that's correct. First of all, one should put in place the conditions for Greece to achieve a control default. That is, of course, the private sector needs to contribute more to the resolution of the Greek crisis, because currently the debt to GDP ratio stands at 140%, and at this rate there is no chance that the Greek economy may ever rebound. No economy in the world could be put on a foot of sustainable growth with such a high debt. Therefore, this debt needs to be lowered, but rather through a controlled default rather than a chaotic, disorderly default. That said, coming to your other point, why the Europeans are systematically behind the curve? I mean, this is absolutely true, and in a way reflects the incomplete institutional architecture of the euro, whereby you do have a centralized single monetary policy managed by the European Central Bank, and yet you have an intergovernmental approach to make decisions on all other aspects of the economic policy making. And therefore, this, you know, being reactive, this being behind the curve is in a way embedded in the European policy making process, because every time there is a shock, then the finance ministers of the euro area would convene, would discuss the best way to proceed, and then of course the national legislatures would need to approve their decisions. Of course, you know, this means that weeks pass by, even months pass by. Just to give you a concrete example, in late July, the euro area leaders agreed to a second program of assistance to Greece, and yet this is still to be discussed by the German parliament and as well as by other euro area national parliaments, and perhaps it won't be discussed until late October, even November. And of course, if we think that Greece is the immediate problem, the immediate challenge that Europe is facing right now, this really highlights the the inconsistency of the policy making approach to the gravity of the crisis before the Europeans.
And Domenico Lombard, I spoke a few days ago with Joseph Stiglitz, who lamented the lack of solidarity within Europe. They have a common currency, but no common sense of political integration and economic survival.
Yes, I do agree with Joe Stiglitz's assessment, in sense that there is a highly integrated, economically integrated area. There is a group of countries that shares the common European currency, but yet this is still a group of sovereign nations who pursues their narrowly defined national interest, whereby the Germans, of course, try to maximize their own interest. The Italians do the same, the Greeks too, and so on and so forth. And of course, by doing so, because they are tied together by a single currency, by a unified, by highly integrated economic area, of course, sometimes, many times actually, they lose sight of their interconnectedness, the scope for huge spillovers and repercussions of one member state vis-a-vis the others. And in fact, just to give one more concrete example, especially in Germany, there is this idea that the Germans are actually, subsidizing the southern states of the European Union. In a fiscal sense, this might be true, because clearly now Germany is pouring money to support Greece, Ireland, Portugal. And yet, if we look at how the European Union works, and especially the single currency works more in detail, we also find evidence of the contrary. That is, the southern states of the European Union provide an important source of market opportunities for the German product. And in fact, the German current account is, of course, in surplus also thanks to the expenditures made by these profligate states in the south. At the same time, the very fact that Germany shares the single currency with other euro area countries implies that Germany can export more and more products abroad, and yet the exchange rate will not appreciate as much as it should, therefore enjoying really a hidden subsidy on their exports worldwide.
Well, just in the last minute we have here, Domenico Lombard, back to the report that China might buy Italian debt. Will that stop the pounding that Italian bonds are getting?
I think this is really a tactical move by the Italian authorities. They are trying to find an alternative backstop to Germany, to the European Central Bank, to loosen their grip on the political decisions that otherwise the Italian authorities would have to make. The Chinese could, of course, offer an important source of funds in the medium term. They are especially interested into some you know, high value companies where the Italian Treasury has stakes into, but they would not really be able nor willing to clearly act as a lender of last resort. This is something that only the European Central Bank and, of course, you know, the other member states of the euro area might be able, might be willing to do should, you know, a full-blown crisis really escalate.
I mean, well, I'm afraid we've run out of...
A strategic move to provide, you know, to strengthen their bargaining power vis-a-vis the European partners more than anything else.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Domenico.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, Domenico Lombardi is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution specializing in global economy and development. He's an expert on G20 and G8 summits, international monetary relations, and global currencies. His current projects focus on the recent international financial crisis, the ongoing European crisis, and the reform of the IMF and the World Bank. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be joined by a veteran Middle East negotiator who has served 6 secretaries of state.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Aaron David Miller, who is a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He has been an advisor to 6 secretaries of state, and under President Clinton served as the Deputy Special Middle East Coordinator for Arab-Israeli negotiations. His books include The Arab States and the Palestinian Question, The PLO and the Politics of Survival, The Search for Security, Saudi Arabian Oil and American Foreign Policy, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and a new book out next year, Can America Have Another Great President? He also has an article in the latest issue of Foreign Policy titled Humpty Dumpty Palestine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron David Miller.
Pleasure to be here.
And Palestinians apparently are going to take their case for statehood to the United Nations Security Council on Friday. So with the U.S. veto expected, what would be the next step?
Well, it really depends what the Palestinians are prepared to do. If they come to the Security Council in seeking full U.N. membership, that requires a majority, and then any of the Perm 5 can veto it. I suspect that the United States will veto it. If they get an inkling, in fact, that not just the Americans but others, the Germans, for example, or the Brits and the French, might not support them, they may decide to go to the General Assembly and to seek enhanced status or a resolution supporting statehood, over which the United States really has no control. So I think this is clearly not their preferred option, but I think that they have so dug themselves into producing something in New York this fall that, frankly, there's no turning back.
But how do you think this will play on the so-called street if you have a situation where most of the world is in favor of a Palestinian state? And after all, we've recently had Sudan, Southern Sudan, and Kosovo accepted as member states, and the United States is the one roadblock. How's that going to play?
Well, it's going to play badly in the Arab and Muslim world for sure, but then our credibility is already much diminished and much reduced. I think the reality is, and everyone should understand this, that the reason this is happening is that the chances for a conflict-ending agreement pursued through negotiations between the current Israeli government and the current Palestinian Authority, the chances of it happening are slim to none. And that's the real problem. The issue is not what form of recognition the UN confers on the Palestinians, whether their status as a member state, as an entity, or a full non-observer member state. that's really not important. The reality is the day after, when all the hoopla and the ceremony have concluded and all the cheering has stopped, Palestinians and Israelis will still, particularly Palestinians, confront the same grim, potentially violent situation. And that's the real problem.
So the warning by the former head of Saudi intelligence, former Saudi ambassador to Washington, suggesting that Saudi Arabia and relations after the expected U.S. veto of Palestinian statehood would be irrevocably affected. Also, you have, of course, the Arab League meeting, and Turkey's prime minister has now taken a strong pro-Palestinian statehood stance there. That warning seemed a little blunt to me. What did you make of it from the Saudis?
The Saudis have been increasingly disenchanted, not just with our peace process policy, but with some of our policies across the board. As they confront the Arab Spring and the Arab Winter in places like Yemen and Bahrain. So I think that the U.S.-Saudi relationship has, the arc of that relationship has been on the downward slide for some time now. Clearly, the Saudis feel very strongly about the Palestinian issue, and they'll push. But the reality is the U.S.-Saudi relationship is too big to fail. I wouldn't be terribly worried about threats, frankly, right now on the part of the Saudis. Yes, they are disenchanted. Yes, you're going to hear a lot of nasty rhetoric. But the reality is both the Americans and the Saudis need one another.
But the Saudi intelligence chief, in his article in the New York Times, said that this would actually, a veto by the United States would be a victory for Syria and Iran. And clearly there are tensions already between Hamas and Syria.
Well, there's no doubt that, first of all, there's no doubt the Iranians will make a lot out of a veto. There's no question about the Syrians. Bashar Assad had so many problems. Now he's fighting for his political survival that I'm not sure this is, frankly, going to provide him much of a boost. The Syrian opposition is not going to be disenchanted or undermined by an American veto. Look, the reality is the President of the United States doesn't want to veto this, but if it comes to a push in the Security Council to admit Palestine as a member state, the President will veto. It cuts across 30 years of American policy that only through negotiations, however bleak the prospects may be, can Israelis and Palestinians sort out their differences. There's no way the United States is going to backtrack from that position. The other reality is that you also have very serious political constraints. This president has no desire, and there's no need, frankly, for a confrontation with the Israelis. So I think that is combining with longstanding American policy to almost guarantee a veto should the Palestinians push it. It's not a happy situation, but unless you end up with a softer landing than the General Assembly, I see no way to avoid a veto.
And Aaron David Milley, you don't think that Einstein's notion of doing the same thing repeatedly, and we've been doing this for 20 years, expecting a different outcome, is a definition of insanity?
I do agree with Einstein. He's a hell of a lot smarter than I am. But the reality is that under certain circumstances, the United States over the last 30 years has, in fact, been an effective broker. Henry Kissinger brokered 3 disengagement agreements, one of which between Israel and Syria has made the Israeli-Syrian border the quietest space in the entire Middle East. Jimmy Carter brokered an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. Jim Baker brought the parties together at Madrid. Bill Clinton pursued some very high wire and very important diplomacy in the latter stages of the now failed Oslo process. The reality is Israelis and Palestinians are not prepared to pay the cost of what would be required to push for a conflict-ending agreement. No American mediator, I don't care how determined, how principled, can overcome that basic obstacle if the Israelis and the Palestinians are not risk-ready and risk-averse. And that's the basic problem here. And they will only become risk-ready when there's sufficient pain on one hand and sufficient prospects of gain on the other to alter their notion that the status quo, altering the status quo, is somehow more risky for them or less risky than maintaining it. And that's the real problem. There is insufficient urgency right now to get the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of the Palestinian Authority into a different mindset. And until you do that, we're going to go nowhere very quickly.
And this, though, Aaron David Miller, is in a new landscape, surely, with the Arab Spring, with the growing isolation of Israel and a clear divisions between the Sunni kings and the Shiite regimes now in Iraq and Iran and to a lesser extent in Syria. I mean, in that broader context, you don't think there's a missed opportunity there, which is what the Saudi...
I don't, because let's translate this into something much more closer to home, and that is the stock market. In periods of certain uncertainty, you tell me, do people take major risks? The answer is no, they don't. And the reality is what the Arab Spring and now winter represents, and let's be clear what's happening. I mean, in Libya may have a happy ending, and Tunisia might as well, but in Egypt, things are very worrisome. In Yemen, things are very unsettled. In Syria, you've got the prospects of civil war. In Bahrain, you have repression. So the Arab Spring is turning into the Arab winter, and in that Arab winter, the space available for America to pursue its interests, given the fact that our policies toward Iran, on counterterrorism, toward democratization, toward Israel, toward Gaza, toward Hamas, are opposed from one end of the Arab world to the other, the space available to America during the next several months and years is likely to continue to contract. So the question, forget America, the question is, an Israeli prime minister with the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty, which is the bulwark, the entire foundation of the structure of peacemaking over the last four decades in this region, if that's under threat, is it really viable that an Israeli prime minister is going to take risks on the Palestinian issue? And the answer is no. And no American president is going to push him to take those risks. What happened over the weekend in Cairo is worrisome, not just on the issue of Israeli-Egyptian relations. It's worrisome from the aspect of maintaining basic law and order and security in Cairo proper. And that's a serious problem these days. And it's led the military, the SCAF, to basically... crack down and impose emergency regulations again, which were supposed to have been lifted once Mubarak was forced out of power. So we're dealing with a situation in which risk-taking is very hard to imagine by just about anybody. The Palestinians are not going to take a risk. The Israelis are certainly not going to take a risk. Barack Obama has so many headaches at home. His what once was viewed as a more certain prospect for re-election has now been thrown wide open by a faltering economy. Nobody wants to take risks. And until people are ready to risk, the status quo is going to prevail.
But Aaron David Miller, the Israelis, and particularly Netanyahu, I think have made it pretty clear on any number of occasions that they view Iran as an existential threat, that is not their principal enemy, their greatest concern. So it's just a little puzzling that an opportunity to diminish Iran's influence would not be something that both the United States and Israel would want to seize.
Well, I think they would if you could find a way. Look, you're not going to be able to force a duly elected government of Israel into a position that it believes, rightly or wrongly, correctly or incorrectly, is running against its own interests. And all I'm suggesting right now is that on the issue of the UN, which is where our conversation started, Barack Obama has no choice, both in terms of consistency of American policy, American electoral politics, but to oppose the Palestinian initiative. It would be one thing if we were on the verge of a breakthrough in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, but we're not. The gaps between Netanyahu and Abbas on borders, security, Jerusalem, refugees are very large. And this isn't something that has just appeared overnight. This has been the basic problem that no one has wanted to face up for a decade, since the Camp David summit.
That, of course, is what your article in Foreign Policy is telling us, the Humpty Dumpty
Palestine. I mean, clearly the U.S. is going to be isolated, and when this happens, we're going to look like the bad guy in the eyes of the world. But what you're arguing in this article is that we should look at the state of Palestinian statehood before statehood, if you will, and you argue that the Palestinians are decentralized, dysfunctional, and divided, that there is 1 million Palestinians in Gaza who are more traditionalist, more Islamist, more oriented towards Egypt. You have 2.6 million Palestinians in the West Bank, which is also heavily occupied by the Israelis. Then you have 300,000 Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And then you have 5 million Palestinians in 58 refugee camps. And then you have 1.3 million Palestinians who are Israeli citizens living inside of Israel. And I take it they're all disparate.
Yeah, I mean, my point is you want to build a successful, effective, coherent national movement. You need control or monopoly over the forces of violence. You need monopoly over a political strategy. You need monopoly over resources. And the fact that the Palestinians have none of that. Abbas has done an amazing job with very little. There's no question about that. I'm simply pointing out the fact that a UN resolution, even if they could get in as member states, isn't going to change the basic reality that you have a divided, dysfunctional, and highly decentralized community. And to build a state out of this that will essentially be one gun, one authority, one negotiating position, under these circumstances is very, very difficult. We are not focused on the right things. We should be focused on whether or not we could actually figure out a way to get Israelis and Palestinians into a negotiation. And I'm not sure it's possible. I guess this is my point. Given the current leaderships on each side, who are not risk-ready but risk-averse, given the deep mutual suspicions that exist, and given the uncertainty in the region, it seems almost unimaginable to me, even without this UN gambit, which frankly is going to take us farther away from that goal, that you can see a two-state solution right now. And I wish it were not so, but it is so. And I think we're going to have to begin to base our post-UN strategy on how to preserve, how to preempt, and how to protect the prospects for a two-state solution, because the opportunity to pursue one is really shrinking. It's going to require Israeli leadership of heroic proportion. You do not have that. It will require, ultimately, a unified Palestinian polity. You do not have that. And it's going to require an enormous amount of support from Arab states who are now wrestling with questions of legitimacy and basic survival. The era of heroic politics in Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking and in Arab-Israeli peacemaking is diminishing. We don't have the Sadats. We don't have the King Husseins. We don't have the Rabins. We don't have the Ben-Gurions. We don't even have the Arafats in his first incarnation. And how you take these kinds of existential decisions from the perspective of the parties without that kind of bold and heroic leadership, men and women who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their constituencies, I don't have an answer to that question. But it is one that is going to need to be addressed if we're ever going to get anywhere.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Aaron David Miller.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Aaron David Miller, who is a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He has been an advisor to 6 secretaries of state, and under President Clinton served as deputy special Middle East coordinator for Arab-Israeli negotiations. His books include The Arab States and the Palestinian Question, The PLO and the Politics of Survival, The Search for Security, Saudi Arabian Oil and American Foreign Policy, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and a new book out next year, Can America Have Another Great President? He also has an article in the latest issue of Foreign Policy titled Humpty Dumpty Palestine. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about this new report on the growing numbers of people in this country living in poverty.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Got a nightlife, lost his day job. Pushing paper, swinging pendulums. Anything to serve a function or to occupy some time. You gotta earn this living somehow. Your good is dead without a bank account. But it's funny how a lot you fell down in that unemployment line with all that trash.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alice O'Connor, who's a historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Poverty, Knowledge, Social Science, Social Policy, and the Poor in 20th Century U.S. History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alice O'Connor.
Thank you.
And this latest report suggesting that poverty in this country has risen to 15.1%. And the total number of people in poverty is an all-time record. It seems a stark contrast, if you will, to what we just witnessed last night, a debate hosted by CNN and the Tea Party, at which Wolf Blitzer posed a hypothetical question to candidate Ron Paul about what would happen if somebody, a young person who couldn't afford health insurance, decided to forego it and then suddenly had a catastrophic situation. And the people in the audience, you know, the question from Blitzer was, would you let this person die? And people in the audience actually cheered and said, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
yeah.
So
I, you know, I've been... I can't say I have been avidly following those debates. I mean, part of me says that I, as a historian, should. So I didn't happen to see that. I'm afraid, though, I mean, I hate to say this, but it doesn't surprise me, partly because I think, you know, that kind of thing is just pandering to people's sense of economic insecurity, and this is something that we have seen over and over again, where it leads to... I mean, in this case, it's not just a backlash against the poor, but I think you have to hear in that this feeling that, you know, when there are all these immigrants around and they're, you know, taking away our social services, so I think that was probably wrapped up in that reaction. But it does speak to, you know, a longer-term politics that has really led to a very powerful and very old, but the resurgence of a very old and powerful discourse that blames the poor for their own poverty, even in the midst of the worst recession, the worst economic downturn that we've had since the Great Depression. It's stunning to me to see how this persists and how it's actually being encouraged with that kind of question and with that kind of a reaction. I mean, that's outrageous.
And the report just released by the U.S. Census Bureau on annual income puts the number of people in poverty at 46.2 million, which is the highest number since the government started tracking poverty in the 1950s. And this probably, I mean, I think it's reasonable to assume that this recession is going to deepen, and a lot of economists think that we're going into a double dip. What's your sense of I mean, I brought up that question just to sort of get a kind of temperature, if you will, of compassion in this country, or the lack thereof. Do you think that there is a broader question here about jobs themselves and the extent to which technology is replacing jobs making people redundant? Do you think that we should have a bigger debate than just this sort of narrow one of sort of shovel ready jobs versus the Republican argument, oh, we can't possibly spend any more money because we have this terrible deficit looming?
Yeah, I do think, and in fact, you see very little of it, and I think partly it's because people are so caught up in this sense of what we have to do tomorrow to get income in the hands of people who are simply trying to get by, and also get incomes in the hands of people who will spend it, and also trying to, you know, stave off the politics of extreme austerity. So in some ways, it's understandable why we haven't had the broader conversation. But it seems to me, I mean, this is again a conversation we have been needing to have for years, that actually, you know, steps back and says, what do we make of the changing nature of work in the United States? How, you know, why are we continuing to, you know, insist that in order to get any benefits whatsoever, people must be in the workforce without actually providing the conditions within which people can get access to work that pays both the wages and provides the benefits they need to sustain themselves. Now, if we're going to continue to be committed to this work-based approach to economic security and to all the benefits that come along with, you know, economic and social citizenship, if you will, in the United States, if we're going to continue to insist that work is at the center of that, it's an obligation. We have an obligation to think hard about how we provide the work. Now, does that mean a shorter work week? Does that mean expanding our notions of what should be compensated, what kinds of labor should be compensated? Does that mean going back to a model of growth that's led by full employment, which would mean you do have to make massive investments in things like building, new kinds of infrastructure? I mean, not just shovel-ready jobs, but really changing the kinds of things we produce in the United States and investing in that. We just are not having that conversation about whether we should be, again, changing that whole workplace model, the old work-based model, in order to accommodate a changing economy.
Again, I'm speaking with Alice O'Connor, who's an historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Poverty, Knowledge, Social Science, Social Policy, and the Poor in 20th Century U.S. History. We're talking about the just-released U.S. Census Bureau's annual income report that puts poverty at an all-time record of 46.2 million people in poverty, the highest number since the 1950s when tracking began. It also talks about how our incomes have fallen and poverty has risen, and the number of Americans without health insurance has jumped again in 2010. It also, though, mentions that a growing number of people in poverty are children. And that seems pretty unconscionable to me, again, going back to the compassion index, mm-hmm. if you will. I mean, perhaps there's such a thing as compassion fatigue, but on the other hand, we are, you know, there's an argument out there that the president is putting forth, which is, you know, why do we need to indulge billionaires at the expense of those who really need a break? And I would argue, surely, that the people who really need a break are the kids in this country. It's no fault of their own that they're living in the richest country on earth, growing up poor. That just doesn't sound right.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, for decades now, activists at the national as well as the local level have been making these kinds of arguments, have been pointing out from a matter not just of compassion, but also, you know, an appeal to conscience, as you were sort of indicating before, but also as a matter of kind of bottom line economic interest. It is ridiculous, and it is certainly against anything we've ever stood for that we would tolerate, you know, the shame of the nation to have such high levels of poverty and need in what still, you know, we still try to present ourselves as the world's most affluent economy, And by many measures, we are in terms of the total wealth that's produced in the United States. But as inequality grows and as the benefits of that wealth are funneled increasingly to the very top, I mean, the uppermost reaches of the economy, we just, you know, even as we do that, we continue to ignore the growing numbers of people who aren't just in need, the need that means, well, you know, you need to stretch out your paying some bills every now and again, but the kind of need that means they are faced with the situation of having no source of adequate income for the foreseeable future. I mean, this is just, this is a world that we thought for a moment and we struggled for quite a while over the course of some decades to leave behind. And now we seem to be not only tolerating it, but in strange ways justifying and embracing it. Somehow, in the name of whether it's promoting self-reliance on the one hand or of insisting that this is the only way that we're going to continue our own path to recovery and growth. I don't see how that adds up by any standard of logic.
Again, I'm speaking with Alice O'Connor, an historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Poverty, Knowledge, Social Science, Social Policy, and the Poor in 20th Century U.S. History. And the debate, of course, or the lack thereof, often is characterized by the Republicans and by the wealthy that they represent as class warfare. But arguably, the wealthiest class has won hands down. And you know, we could consider ourselves all prisoners of war in a lost class warfare battle. My sense, though, is that things are actually getting meaner. I started out by mentioning the people, yelling out at the Tea Party CNN debate last night, saying, "Sure, let the uninsured person die. Pull the plug." But the sense that that we have this large number of children in poverty, etc. I'm not sure that compassion is the best argument. And how do you sort of restructure or represent the notion of the American dream? We have this, perhaps it's an illusion that we are this middle class country. All of the people in the middle class are entitled to the American dream. There's a sense that we're all being downsized. How do you create solidarity, if you will, in an environment where there is, I think, this kind of divide and conquer mentality, particularly exhibited by the Tea Party, that we've got ours and we're not going to share it with all you minorities and freeloaders?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think in some ways that the notion that we are going to somehow convince those people that they ought to get beyond the kinds of redistributive policies, you know, downwardly redistributive policies that would, you know, restore us to a much fairer and more just economy, and also a stronger economy. I just don't think trying to win their hearts and minds is the way to go. I think actually the way to go is to build a counter movement, and that is what to me is going to win the day. The strategy is not necessarily to convince people who clearly have dug their heels into a certain way of thinking and a certain politics that benefits the haves at the cost of the have-nots, and that puts the, you know, interests of certain groups of individuals above those of the greater public, but that also traffics in this kind of meanness that you talked about before. I just don't think they are going to be convinced, and to try to bring them along and to build consensus is not what's going to change the direction of the economy at this point. What's going to change the direction of the economy is building coalitions of people who embrace the values of economic fairness and economic justice. And I actually remain convinced that that's the majority of people in the United States. But the majority of people are not being represented. Certainly the people who show up in those poverty numbers are not being represented in our politics and political discourse. But also, you know, the majority of middle and working class Americans who really continue to suffer from the Great Recession, their voices are not being represented in current debates in Washington either.
So just in closing, Alice O'Connor, when we talk about building new coalitions and in effect putting some, I guess ultimately it comes down to putting the wind behind the president, who ostensibly is trying to help the unemployed and to restore and revive the economy, but he's clearly not going to get any help from the Republicans. And unless, I think, of course, progressives are all whining and carping about how he hasn't done enough, so they don't have his back. I'm not sure who has the president's back at this point. But it seems to me that an obvious coalition, at least in terms of intellectual ammunition, is coming from the majority of economists who are saying, and these are the Wall Street people, because you recall after the debt ceiling hostage crisis was resolved, the market tanked because the smart money know that you can't take $1 trillion out of a sick economy and do anything else but perhaps create a double dip. So a lot of economists are saying this is our economic policy is insane, and that the president has the right ideas, and it would be a win-win. It would put people back to work, and let's face it, this study that we're talking about from the Census Bureau has just pointed out that unemployment benefits have kept 3.2 million people out of poverty in 2010, and that Social Security retirement benefits did the same for nearly 14 million seniors. So why want to unnecessarily impoverish your fellow American citizens? It's a win-win if you know, it's what goes back to what JFK said, you know, a rising tide raises all boats.
But it only raises all boats if you make the effort to make that to create the conditions of shared prosperity. I mean, it doesn't automatically. The rising tide does not automatically. You need a different kind of policy, you know, and a different kind of political economy in order for a rising tide to raise all boats. Look, you know, that kind of politics has, you know, in our past had enormous purchase. And like, again, to sort of build on this notion of purchase, the whole idea of building coalitions around the need to expand the majority's purchasing power as a matter of economic interest, as a matter of getting the economy going again, is something that, you're absolutely right. You know, the majority of economists are going to say that is what we need to do. It is just unfathomable and inexplicable to me why, though, we have allowed ourselves, you know, to get to the point where the voices of economic irrationality are prevailing in Washington. I mean, there's not a simple explanation for this.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alice O'Connor. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Okay, you too.
And again, I've been speaking with Alice O'Connor, who's a historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Poverty, Knowledge, Social Science, Social Policy, and the Poor in 20th Century U.S. History. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Domenico Lombard, who's an Italian scholar at the Brookings Institution. He's a specialist on international monetary relations and global currencies. Italy, of course, is called too big to fail and too big to bail in terms of the euro crisis. And Greece, of course, is poised to default. There's a panicked conversation is supposed to take place on Wednesday between the French president, the German chancellor, and the Greek prime minister. But most people think it's basically a question of whether or not it's going to be a disorderly or an orderly default. But Italy, of course, is very key. Domenico said that I asked him about the reports that China is going to buy sovereign debt to try and stave off the pounding that Italy's getting in the bond market. He seemed to think that they were actually looking for some good assets to buy, some companies that are successful Italian companies that have a large stake of government. Where the government has a large stake in these companies might be what they're really after. But he certainly thought that the Europeans have been consistently behind the curve. They don't have the institutions and the mechanisms to deal with this. It is not a very encouraging picture. The Secretary of Treasury is going over on Friday to meet in Europe. The President has already expressed some concerns. The general impression you get is that it's somewhat out of control, and I wouldn't bet on Europe holding this thing together. Then we spoke with Aaron David Miller, who has been a veteran Middle East negotiator. He served 6 Secretary of State. He has a piece in Foreign Policy, Humpty Dumpty Palestine. I asked him about the Saudi warning that if the U.S. vetoes Palestinian statehood, it's going to change relationships, and a veto by the U.S. is going to only help Iran and Syria and further isolate America. He seemed to think that things are so bad, at any rate, in terms of U.S. Relations in that part of the world, it's not going to make a lot of difference. But his main point is that as bad as the situation is, and as much as the U.S. is going to get a black eye out of this, we shouldn't be too romantic about the idea of a Palestinian state. And he went on to list the various components that make this Palestinian state so dysfunctional and disparate. You've got Gaza, you've got the West Bank, which the Israelis heavily control, you've got East Jerusalem, you've got almost more Palestinians in 58 refugee camps, and then, of course, you've got 1.3 million Palestinian Israeli citizens, and there's no cohesion between these groups. So he was giving a pretty dismal picture of it. And then finally, we spoke about this new report by the Census Bureau on poverty in America. 46.2 Americans now in poverty, many of them children. It's an absolute outrage. And what more can I say? It is absolutely disgraceful. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.